Good morning, everybody. It's Jim Bianco, and welcome to our conference call. Let me go through the usual housekeeping up front, and then we'll get started. There is a presentation. If you didn't get it for any reason or the link didn't work, you could send an email to us in the office at ryanmalo at rmalo@biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn around and send it to you as an attachment. Okay, when will the bank start lending? The premise of today's conference call is the financial system, again, is running through its usual pattern of late in the quarter. It seems to show some strength. Early in the quarter, right before we get earnings announcements, they start to weaken again when they realize that the strength was more hope than reality. But as we look forward into 2009, the question becomes, when is the economy going to bottom out and turn around? And a companion question with that is, when is the banking system going to start to lend? Because once we start getting serious lending going on, then we could start to see a turnaround in the economy. I'm going to give an answer which I think is a little different because I haven't heard many people talk about it. And I would say it's really not about the banking system as much as it's about the securitization markets. And the banking system cannot compensate for the loss of the securitization markets, and I've got some charts I want to show about that in a few minutes. And that really what we should be talking about is, when are we going to restart securitization as opposed to when are we going to restart banking, because that's going to be the issue that we've got before us. So with that as kind of a little bit of a background, let's jump to page 2. Almost $1 trillion of losses. For those of you that have a Bloomberg, which I believe is most of you, WDCI, this is just a reformat of the WDCI screen. As of yesterday, it was $996.7 billion. Today, it's $1,004.2 billion. These numbers do go up and down a little bit because Bloomberg does try to keep estimates on them as opposed to actual numbers, so sometimes the estimates are a little bit off, and then there's restatements along the way as well, too. So we're right at $1 trillion. In losses, as it shows. And I've argued that the most important statistic here is the difference between losses and capital raised. And you can see that as you look at them, they're fairly close. But bear in mind that almost half of that capital raised has been government injections as opposed to private capital being added to the system. And those government injections have not been as efficient for the banking system as when they've gone out and raised private capital. So the net of it is that the banks have lost more money than they've raised. If you then assume that some of that money also was inefficiently given to them through the TARP and through other European government bailouts of their banking system, the banking system has shrunk. And again, I would argue, and I've not been able to find good statistics on this, but I'll still argue it from a conceptual standpoint, the biggest problem that we have right now is that the financial system is too small relative to the size of the real economy. And being that the financial system is too small relative to the size of the real economy, it can't support the size of the real economy, and that's why we're getting all of the bailouts to try and plug that gap. But let's move on to the banking system. Page 3. And I want to make a statement here that I'm sure bankers will be happy to say, because they've been trying to say this, and that is that the banks are lending. If you look at the upper left chart, commercial and industrial loans did spike up in September and October. The belief is a lot of that was commitments, lines of credit that were drawn down, especially when the commercial paper market seized up, and other commitments that banks had that they had to honor from a lot of their borrowers. If you look at the chart below it, a longer-term picture of year-over-year change in total loans at banks, yes, we've had credit crunches in the past when banking lending has been less than zero, we've not seen that happen in the past this time. What we've got this time is we've got the bank lending that has been going on right now is about running at 5% on a year-over-year basis. So it's running a little bit higher than it has run in the last three credit crunches or so. If you look at the chart on the right on page 3, you'll see that total growth of the banking assets, which is the blue line on the blue chart, has been growing at nearly 13% a year. So the banks are expanding their assets. They are expanding the size of their balance sheet. The red line on the right on page 3 does show the size of their total assets in their and you can see that that's roughly around $12 trillion. So what do these three charts tell us in total? They tell us that largely that the banking system is lending. But let's look beyond the banking system and let's look at what we have on page 4, which we call total private credit market debt, or measuring total credit creation. And what we've got here on this chart in the left, in blue, on the upper left line is private credit market debt. This is total credit creation, not including treasuries, municipals, or agency debt. As of the end of the third quarter, this is flow of funds statistics, it was at $35.289 trillion. So total credit in the system, less treasuries, munis, and agencies. Agencies we could debate a little bit, but I decided for these purposes to take them out because they're so closely aligned with the federal government. And you look at more of a purely private measure, that the agency secure, that we've got $35 trillion worth of private credit. The bottom chart, the red line, the year-over-year change, you could see is slumping down to around 3.4%, the lowest level we've seen since the early 1990s. But let's look at the chart on the right. The chart on the right it shows the various measures of where credit comes from. The red line on the chart on the right shows total banking loans and advances. That means that in general, of private credit market creation, or private credit creation in the private markets, 23% of it comes from the banking system. Or the banking system has a market share of only about 23 to 25%. I'm using 25% because I'm assuming that when we get fourth quarter numbers, that the banking system shares have gone up quite a bit. They're not the dominant player in the system. They are just one of a course in the system. Now let's go to the charts on page 5 and let's measure the banking system against securitization. The red line on the chart on the right, left, if you look at the chart on the left, the red line is, the again, that same chart that I showed on the prior chart, which is total bank loans and advances and consumer loans. The banking system's 22-23% of credit creation. The blue line is total securitization. Securitization is now accounts for a larger outstanding amount of credit than the banking system. If you look at the chart in the upper right, total credit creation, you could see that since the mid-1980s, securitization accounted for more credit creation than the banking system has. And if you look at the chart in the lower right, the rise and fall in securitization, this shows the percentage of securitization that is made up by the total amount of credit creation made up by securitization. The red line is a four-quarter average. The gray line is the actual quarterly plots. As of late as the second quarter of 2007, 27% of all credit creation was coming from securitization. In Q3, as of September 30th, it was down to 10, and that number has probably fallen even more significantly as we look into the fourth quarter. Because if we go to the charts on page 6, you could see that in the fourth quarter, well, first of all, the chart on the right, total CDO market issuance shows a huge round trip from 2004 to the third quarter that it's dropped off to practically nothing. But if you look at the charts on the left, total ABS issuance and total CMO agency and whole loan issuance, in November and December, they were essentially zero after the credit crisis really hit. So here's the bottom line with a lot of these charts. A bottom line with a lot of these charts is that securitization was a larger factor in creating credit than the banking system. We could pump up the banking system with all the credit we want and beg the banking system to hand out loans, but we're asking somebody, if you want to put it in business terms, we're asking somebody with a 25% market share to say that the big players are now struggling. Can you take your 25% market share to 60% immediately? And the answer is no, they can't. First of all, they don't want to, because of a sound business decision that they don't want to be handing out massive amounts of loans in a recession. Second of all, we're talking about a banking system with $12 trillion worth of lending, that they, to have them ramp it up in terms of trillions, that's with a T, not a B, they're just not equipped to do that. So I think it's been a little bit unfair to turn to the banking system and say, here, make up for the loss of the securitization markets now. And that's where the problem comes in. In most of the measures, the banks are lending. They are lending. Now, maybe they could lend a little bit more. There's no doubt about that. But they are lending. They're not hoarding the money, as a lot of people say. I think that comment that the banks are not lending comes from this idea that we want to go back to 2006 and 2007, maybe 2005. And in order to go back to that period, we need an active and vibrant securitization market. We're mad that the banks have not been able to compensate for the loss of securitization. They can't do that. Therein lies the problem. So that begs the next question. What brings back securitization? And the answer, I think, to bringing back securitization is the independent arbiter. What I thought was the glue that made securitization work was the belief that the rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, S&P, were independent objective arbiters that could assign value, risk values to various securitization tranches. This is AAA, this is single A, this is the equity tranche, this is what their relative ratings are worth. And we believe that. So the problem with securitization is it's too complicated for most players to understand. Yes, the Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, the PIMCOs, the Wellingtons, they have departments that can measure and make objective evaluations on securitization deals. But a lot of second, third, and fourth tier insurance companies, banks, investment managers did not. And they relied on the independent arbiters of the rating agencies to give them some kind of a measure as to the relative values of various securities. The independent evaluators have now been, have lost their credibility. We don't trust them, I think deservedly so, but therein lies the biggest problem with securitization, I think. Securitization is always going to be a complicated issue that's going to be very difficult to get several thousand money managers to completely understand. So that independent arbiter is necessary, I think, to get that market moving again. Moody's, S&P, and Fitch have done nothing to restore their confidence. I don't know if they can. But short of them, there is nobody else out there that has the ability or the credibility to start rating these securities. So, yes, you can put together a securitization deal and maybe sell it to a BlackRock, a PIMCO, a Wellington, or somebody along those lines that can independently measure it. But that alone is not going to get the securitization market moving to the degree that we need it to move. What's going to get it moving is wherever we can get the confidence of the second, third, and fourth tier players. And that's the struggle for the securitization industry that, frankly, they don't have an answer for. The struggle for us is until securitization moves forward, we could throw all the money we want at the banking system, and there's only so much that the banking system can do. All right, let's move to page 7. Again, what is the loss of the securitization market and the shrinkage of the banking system in general meant? It's meant that the financial system is shrunk, the financial system is too small relative to the real economy, and therefore we've used the fancy phrase that we are going to have a delevering. Now, we like to say we're going to have a delevering. When I mean we, I mean mainly politicians and others like to say that it's necessary to have a delevering, but they really don't want a delevering because deleveraging means no more auto industry, may possibly means no more GE because we have no more commercial paper market. It means many banks go out of business. It means that a lot of auto finance companies like GM go out of business. That's what deleveraging means. Deleveraging means we have to get the real economy back to the size that the financial system can support. We don't want to do that because that's nasty and that's ugly, and I understand it. So in the place of the loss of securitization and the shrinkage of the financial system, we've plugged that hole by having the government bailouts serve as the missing part of the financial system. And the chart, the table on the left on page 7 is our update on the broad strokes on a lot of the programs that we've had in the last several months put together. As far as what we're looking at a maximum potential of $8.7 trillion with a T if you include all the guarantees. And so far, all the government programs together have been about $3.1 or $3 trillion. Of course, almost two of it has been the Fed, and 350 of that has been the TARP, with a couple of other programs along the way, like the stimulus package from last spring. We've got the second half of the TARP. We've got the other stimulus package coming, which could bump that up, the two of them together, by another $1 trillion. Those programs are taking the place of the financial system, which cannot. The consequence of some of those programs is the chart in the lower right, which is the federal budget surplus deficit. It shows that as of December, we had an $816 billion deficit for calendar year 2008. Remember, the fiscal year starts in September 30th. So, and you can see the slope of the line in the deficit. It is really mushrooming out. And of course, that does not include the upcoming stimulus package, because these are actual deficit numbers. And so the actual deficit in 6 months or 9 months can really be a sight to behold. It already is a sight to behold at $816 billion, nothing quite like we've ever seen before. So this is what we've been doing, is we've been having the government step into the place of the financial system. Now, if we turn to page 8, another place where we've had the government stepping in, of course, is the Federal Reserve. If you look at the chart on the left, this is the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet has ballooned from $888 billion in September to about $2.2 trillion right now. If I was to recast the Fed's balance sheet, let me use the charts on the right, the top chart. The blue line along the bottom in the top chart is required reserves by the banking system, which is still running at around $60 billion. Up until September, total reserves in the banking system was running about $1 billion or two more than that. So if the banking system required $60 billion, the Fed would have $62 billion in reserves. Now, not everybody here is a monitor, so let me just give you a quick 30-second definition of what goes on here. As a bank, you're required to keep reserves relative to the size of your assets in an account at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has the ability to add reserves to your account or drain reserves from your account. Those are the open market operations that we talk about. Adding or draining reserves from your account is the way that the Fed can regulate the growth of the banking system to speed it up or slow it down depending on where they think the economy is going next. Normally, they would keep total reserves and required reserves very, very close to each other. Since the Fed has been expanding their balance sheet like crazy, what they've been doing is adding reserves to the banking system's reserves accounts. So as of December 31st, the last number, while the banking system was only required based on the size of the assets and the type of loans that they had and the appropriate reserve requirements, that they were only required to have about $63 or $64 billion in their reserve accounts in total. In actuality, they had somewhere over $800 billion. We've never seen a excess reserve gap quite like this. In fact, I show the excess reserve gap on the bottom chart. This means that the banking system could expand its lending base by trillions. They're not doing it because they're not equipped to do this, nor should we expect the banks to start handing out money like drunken sailors. We've set it up so that the banks can replace the securitization markets. The banks simply cannot replace the securitization markets. So while we've been bailing out the banking system, It's really the securitization markets that is the problem. Now, there is something coming in the form of securitization bailout, and that is TALF 2. The TALF is the Treasury Assistance Lending Facility. Number one is what we all are familiar with. They've been buying mortgage-backed securities, and they've been buying agency securities. $500 billion program to buy mortgage-backed securities, $100 billion program to buy agency securities. Those programs have been in place now for a couple of weeks. We've seen the results of those programs because we've seen mortgage rates falling. We've seen their spreads collapsing because we've seen the weight of the Fed pushing those down. TALF 2 is going to be that they're going to start trying to buy securitization deals. I thought it was interesting that they made both of these announcements at the same time back in November. TALF 2, where they're going to buy securitization deals, won't start until February, maybe even the end of February, because while the Fed could say we're going to buy agencies and mortgages and put together a program in a couple of weeks to do it, it takes them months to put together the proper program and the proper outside managers to buy securitization. Again, because securitization is very, very complicated, and it's not easy for the Fed to understand. So we'll get some relief in the securitization markets as we move forward from here with Fed buying, but it's not necessarily a thaw in the markets. And that brings me to the chart on page 9. And for the rest of the charts of the handout, what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk a little bit about the markets per se. So far I've talked about that the problem here is that the real credit crisis has been not only a shrinkage in the banking system, but it's been the loss of the securitization markets. The financial system cannot support the size of the economy. The government bailouts have been the plug to keep the economy at its current size while we try to figure out what to do in terms of trying to pump up the financial system or manage a shrink in the real economy to get those two back into equilibrium. It appears we don't want to manage a shrink in the real economy, that while we say it, when push comes to shove, we'll even give Bank of America a loan to finish the Merrill Lynch deal. We will give GMAC a loan, even though we gave them a bunch of criteria, debt-to-equity swaps and some other rules that they had to meet in order to get TARP money. They did not meet it, but we gave them the money anyway. So we don't want to, maybe we shouldn't shrink the real economy to get back in equilibrium with the financial system. The fact is we don't want to do it. We're not going to do it. So we're trying to figure out how to grow the financial system back so that it can support the size of the economy. The government programs to date have had some pleasurable outcomes. They have produced lower LIBOR. The currency swap lines, the $900 billion TAF, the term auction facility, the original acronym that starts with T that was put together in December of 2007, they have helped to manipulate LIBOR lower. The TALF 1 has helped to manipulate mortgages and agencies lower. But let's not confuse that with healing in the credit markets. Lower interest rates is not the same thing as healing. Lower interest rates, if they come about because of Fed or government manipulation, that is not a healed market. And that's the way that everybody seems to want to think about this. The rates go down, that seems to be a better scenario than rates going up, and rates going down must mean healing. So let's take the chart on page 9 with that as backdrop. This chart here shows it's all the same trade. And I've, first of all, a little bit of a measure on the chart. The red line on the top is the S&P 500 repeated twice going back about 10 years, shows the 2000 peak, and it shows the 2007 peak. Underneath it are 8 different markets, 8 markets that should be unrelated to each other. These are the same 8 that I've always been using on this various iterations of this chart. On each chart is a correlation to the S&P 500. The chart on the right shows that every day when we recalculate, the S&P 500's correlation is over the previous 6 months. 6 months, half a year to help compensate for seasonality. The chart on the right, every day we find whatever happens to be the market that is least correlated to the S&P It is currently the one in the lower left, the MOVE index. Bond market volatility has been 81% correlated to the S&P over the last 6 months. We plot that number. And you could see that in the last few months, we've had a consistently high correlation to the S&P than we've seen at any time in the last many years. It's all the same trade. Now, I've argued that this is not a normal circumstance in the markets. They should not be trading with a high degree of correlation. There should not be a loss of diversification. The reason that there is because in a crisis like we have now, there's really only one story and there's really only one trade. We might be nominally an emerging market trader trading Brazilian stocks, or a currency trader trading the euro, or a commodities trader trading, you know, one of the members of the CRB. But in fact, we're all trading the same thing, whether we're equity traders or anything in between, is that we're trading on our perceptions of the credit crisis. When it looks like it's getting better, commodities go up, credit spreads tighten, stock market goes up. When things are getting worse, commodities go down, the stock market goes down, credit spreads widen. One sign that we are having real healing would be a break in the correlations between all of these markets. They start to diverge, and they start to go back to their own individual fundamentals. I've argued, though, that in some cases with crude oil, that the fundamental that's driving crude oil is perceptions in the credit markets. But if you watch CNBC or read the paper, they'll torture arguments with supply and with inventories and with demand to try and explain why we've fallen $100 in the last few months. And then when they can't figure that out, they'll throw their hands in the air and say it was all speculators anyway. I think the dominant story that's pushed it lower, pushed crude oil unprecedentedly $100 lower, is the dominant story that's pushed the stock market down to the biggest sell-off it's had in 60 years, that's pushed credit spreads to the widest levels we've seen since the Great Depression. It's all the same thing, the credit crisis. When we start to see divergence, then we know that the credit crisis is starting to get better. As we move on to the chart on page 10, I'm going to take these charts in reverse order that I usually take them. I'm going to start with the riskiest market and move to the least riskiest market. Equities. I've made the case in the last couple of conference calls that we were very close to a bottom. I've now laid out the case here that we still have the problem with the loss of securitization. So let me reconcile those two. The stock market has sold off more than at any point since the 1940s. It's more than 50% off of its high at its lows in November. If you look at the chart in the upper right, bank stocks are again pushing their November 20th lows. This is a chart of the bank stock index going back a couple of years. If you look at the chart in the lower right, volatility in the stock market is the highest point we've seen at any point since the Great Depression. Yes, we have a loss of securitization, but we've also had one of the biggest sell-offs we've seen in 60 years. I've made the case that November 20th, somewhere in that range, the stock market probably found a bottom. But because of the loss of securitization and no signs, at least at this point, that it's going to get better, I'm in what we would call the L camp. The market is going to go from giving you minus 30 or 40% returns to zero returns with a lot of volatility. What we've seen happen in the first couple of weeks of this year has been more of the same. Yes, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 150 points again today after being down almost 200 yesterday and been selling off for, this would be its eighth day in a row that it's been down, but yet it's still holding above those October 10th lows. Get used to the volatility. Recognize that we're generally in a choppy sideways market. Or to put it in a different term, the media likes to say that a 20% gain in the stock market is a bull market. And they were talking about whether or not the push off the November 20th low to the December highs, which was a 21% rally, was indeed a new bull market. Well, if you're going to use 20% as your definition, then expect four or five bull markets in 2009. We'll have a 20% rally, we'll give it all back. We'll have another 20% rally, we'll give it all back. And that's where the sideways action starts in the marketplace. If we go to the chart on page 11, I've made a similar argument with credit spreads, that while stocks were bottoming, credit spreads at the widest levels that we've seen in some respects, if you look at the Moody's numbers, since the 1930s, and I don't show Moody's, but here in the upper left, I show investment grade spreads out at around investment grade spreads on the upper left, high yield spreads in the lower right, leverage loan prices in the upper right, and the iTraxx crossover in the lower right. If you look at these spreads, they peaked roughly around December 15th to December 18th, and they've come in some. See that in the upper left with investment grade spreads and in the lower left with high yield spreads most commonly. Again, the same type of argument. The worst sell-offs, the widest level since the 1930s, the 50% decline in stocks has priced in a tremendous amount of damage being done to the economy and to the financial markets. And that's why I think we're trading in this period, a period of very wide growth or of very widening spreads to choppy sideways types of actions. Maybe nominally we sneak out a new basis point or two high, but I think that that's been about it. But bear in mind what I'm arguing here is you're not going to get that immediate type of tightening gratification. It's going to be a difficult market to get a hold of. Or as when I was talking with one high yield trader, I said, maybe the terminology needs to change, that you will then at one point say to me, yes, I just bought some high yield and it widened 200 basis points after I bought it. So it hasn't done much since I bought it. Now, most people would not think that after you've bought credit and it's widened 200 basis points, that it hasn't done much. That sounds like a bad trade. But maybe in this environment, we have to learn that it is not a bad trade, that that's the type of volatility that we're in right now. As we go on to page 12, muni spreads. And let me apologize. The text on this is old. I thought I had changed the text, so the text is just dated. It's not incorrect. But the charts on this page are correct. The top chart shows GOs as a percent of treasuries. And the bottom chart just shows 10 years because it's a longer-term period to just show you how truly unprecedented what we've seen happen in munis, just like what we've seen happen in credit, just like what we've seen happen in stocks. Now, in the case of munis, we've seen a lot more tightening in the case of munis than we did in credit or in the stock market. That could also be stimulus talk right now because a lot of these budget deficits by these states and local municipalities could be getting bailed out by these shovel-ready projects that the Obama administration is talking about. Remember now that most of the stimulus projects they're talking about, infrastructure spending, usually occurs at the state level. It's the states that do that type of spending. If the federal government is going to start to do it, it's going to relieve the states of their budget deficits, it's going to relieve the states of their funding burdens, and that should help munis. It has, they've tightened, but if you look at the lower chart, again, we're still at levels that are considered to be, you know, crisis levels. They're just not the December level that we saw, just a few months ago. So munis seem to be getting better as well, too. As we move to page 13, agencies. Now, when we get into agencies, we then start to get into a little bit more of a gray area when it comes to agencies. First of all, let's take the agency chart in the upper right. Five-year Fannie Mae yields divided by five-year or less five-year Treasury yields, the spread. Agencies had widened up until the November 20th levels, and then there was a gigantic narrowing of agency spreads after that. What was interesting was the hope was back at the September lows was that we would see agencies narrow after Fannie and Freddie were nationalized. It didn't occur because after the September lows, we saw massive widening. It was only the announcement of the TALF that the Fed was going to buy agency securities that we finally started to see the narrowing. I've argued that this was a sign, and this is something that we should learn from this, is that it doesn't matter. Guarantees don't produce tighter markets. What produces tighter markets is the idea that somebody is buying the market right now. And for the moment, from September to November, we didn't have anybody buying the market. But once we started having the Fed buying the market, we had some major tightening. Now, why did guarantees not work? The charts around it. The chart on the bottom, foreign central bank holdings of agencies, that chart on the bottom shows that it peaked in July, and it's down a lot. In fact, it peaked the day that Paulson was asking for his bazooka, literally July 16th. So foreign central banks stopped buying agencies, and the chart in the left, in the upper left part of it, shows the outflows that we've seen happen as well, too, from agencies' purchases by foreigners. Foreigners have become huge net sellers of agencies. I think what happened was the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie was a move to try and placate foreigners, and it didn't work, and that's why spreads continue to widen, because we lost that big buyer. And it was only when we replaced them with the government itself, the Fed, that things got better. Well, at the moment, does that mean that we're seeing healing in agencies? I would argue no, we're not seeing healing in agencies. We're seeing government manipulation in agencies as we move those markets lower. The next chart is mortgages on page 14, mortgage rates and spreads. First of all, a little bit of explanation. Let me take the lower left chart, Fannie Mae 30-year mortgage spreads. 30-year mortgages have tightened quite a bit since the announcement of the TALF back in late November. The upper left chart shows 30-year Fannie Mae yields and 10-year treasuries. This chart basically shows the two components that make up the spread. We've had a lot of tightening of those spreads. If you look at the chart on the right, the upper chart shows conforming mortgages and jumbos. Remember now, the Fed is buying conforming mortgages. That's why the red line is back down to its 2003 lows. Jumbo mortgages are not seeing much in the way of buying. That's why the green line, the bottom chart, is the spread has been widening out quite a bit, as we've seen, to record wides. Mortgage rates have been going down because the Fed has a $500 billion program to buy mortgages, not necessarily because we've seen purchases of mortgages. The idea behind forcing mortgages lower was supposed to spur purchases and potential refinancings. That has not been working to date. In today's news clips, I have a couple of charts right in the first block showing that what has happened with forcing large rates lower is we've had a huge refinancing boom. And to be blunt about it, to get the point across, a bunch of people that didn't need refinancings are getting them. In other words, if you're delinquent on your payments, if you're in a foreclosure, or you're upside down in your mortgage, you're not getting a refinancing. Refinancing still requires that the house go through an evaluation and an assessment. And when it's realized that the value of the house is worth more than the mortgage, the LTV is above 100, you can't refinance. So refinancing only occurs for those with good credit and have sufficient equity in their home. Well, they weren't in the process of getting tossed out of their house in the first place. But also what we show is a second chart. Purchases are not going up. So as we force mortgage rates lower, it's not helping to revive the housing market. It's helping those few mortgage brokers that are in business generate more commissions by doing refinancings. It's not increasing mortgage purchases, and it's not helping those that need that are in trouble, either in delinquency, foreclosure, or have an LTV above 100. So this mortgage rates has not been as successful as a lot of people have hoped it would be. And again, is the narrowing spread because rates are getting better or the market is healing? No, it's because the government has been buying. As we move to page 15, on page 15, I show what I've called medicated markets. Now, these markets, I've termed, when you get down to these very short-term markets, these medicated markets, you've got basically no market at all. You've got just the Federal Reserve that is purchasing these markets, commercial paper. The top left chart shows 30-day AA commercial paper rates. Non-financial is red. Asset-backed is green, and financial is blue. You can see how a lot of those rates are starting to approach zero with the funds rate as it is in a 0 to 25 basis point range. The bottom, the chart on the right, outstanding levels of financial commercial paper, that chart on the right shows that we've seen a bump up in the levels of commercial paper over the last couple of weeks. But the question becomes, is this mean that the market's getting better? Well, most commentators are saying, yes, it's getting better. But the bigger question is, who's buying commercial paper? The bottom chart, I think, tells us, the bottom left chart, percentage of commercial paper that matures in 4 days or less. Remember that before the crisis, roughly 50 or 60% of commercial paper was overnight commercial paper. The other 50 or 60% was term paper, something longer than overnight. When the crisis hit, the only type of funding you could get was overnight funding, especially if you're a financial company, which is what this shows. That's not good, because at any point, you could not roll over your commercial paper, and you've got 1 day to find that lost financing, or you're insolvent. You need term financial paper. You can't get it. The Fed stepped in with its commercial paper funding program, the CPFF. It is buying 30-day commercial paper. And what we found has happened is at the end of October, when they first started the program, the percentage of overnight paper dropped to 25%. That means that 75% was term. That was the Fed's purchase. 30-day paper, it spiked down again, the overnight commercial paper. That was the Fed rolling over. It happened again as well in December, in the late December numbers as well, too. So there is no commercial paper market. There is some overnight funding you can get at a premium, and then you have to apply and get approved to sell your commercial paper to the Federal Reserve. That's all that there essentially is in the commercial paper market. So for those that are looking at the markets getting better by the definition of markets getting better being falling rates, that's not necessarily happening. The final chart, page 16, is LIBOR. And the LIBOR market is falling again. Another one that everybody seems to be looking at first, three-month LIBOR is the red line in the upper left chart. The blue line in the upper left chart is three-month T-bills. The green line is the TED spread, or the Treasury Eurodollar or LIBOR spread. It has been coming in a bit to just under 100 basis points. Again, people are looking at that as a sign that the markets are getting better. The problem is, the big reason that they're getting better is government intervention. The TAF auction is one, as I show on the right here, $500 billion of TAF auction purchases is why this market is getting better. Bottom line with all of this, and then I'll take some questions, is that the loss of the securitization markets is the big issue in front of us right now. That's what needs to be addressed as we move forward. The loss of the securitization markets cannot be overstated. The banking system only has a 25% market share. It cannot compensate for the loss of the securitization markets. The markets have discounted the biggest sell. The markets have had their biggest sell-off since the Great Depression. I think that they've discounted quite a bit of damage in the markets, and that's why I think they're going to trend sideways. All of the markets that are in a downtrend, you can attribute to the numerous government programs to force them lower, not that there's actually any private market buying going on in those markets. And so, therefore, it's really hard to make the case that we're seeing a healing in the credit markets if you're looking at LIBOR or you're looking at the TED spread or you're looking at commercial paper or you're looking at mortgage rates. And as a matter of fact, most of the litany of people that measure the credit markets look at those same things over and over again and say, these spreads are coming in better, better, better. That's not necessarily the case when all it is the government buying. So I think that we've got still a protracted period of high volatility, sideways action. Yes, we can still visit the lows in the stock market. We can still visit the wides in credit. that in the current mentality is not good. You could still have a 15% sell-off from the stock market in the first week of January back down to visit the November lows. You could still have high yield widen 200 or 300 basis points to go back to 2200 on its OAS according to the Merrill indices. But is it going to go to 3,000? No, I don't necessarily think it's going to go there. So what you're trading is a 40% decline in equities for zero with a lot of volatility. You're trading a 24% total return loss in high yield annualized over the fourth quarter to zero with a lot of volatility. That is where we are. The sign is going to be to get the securitization markets moving. If you want signs that things are seriously getting better, I would look at that chart that I had. I would look at the chart that I had on page 9. The chart on page 9 was all markets behave as one. It's all the same trade. That when you start to see on that chart on the right a divergence, that you start to see those spreads, those correlations start falling, that markets are behaving independently. That means that they've moved on from just the initial story to a larger story of the credit crisis in general is dissipated. We're going back to our individual fundamentals. Final thought, and then I'll take some questions. And the final thought is that in this environment, I think Bill Gross summed it up the best, and I can't disagree with him. That is that the most important fundamental for 2009 is going to be figure out what the next bailout is going to be and front run the Fed or the Treasury before they buy it. They are the only player in the market. They are the only player that seems to be buying. They are the reason that anything is tightening. As the next half of the TARP comes, as the stimulus package comes, as more plans come into place, TALF 2, to be able to say, what is the Fed going to do next? What are they going to buy next? And front run the Fed before they start to force those rates lower. That's the only story that we've got going, more so than inflation, more so than economic growth, more so than earnings, or any of the other traditional fundamentals. All right, let me thank everybody there. And let me say that we're going to open up for questions. A couple of ways you can ask questions. If you're on the webcast, you can type it in on the right there in the webcast. You can email me at jbianco@biancoresearch.com. Or if you're on the audio call, you can hit 7#, 7#, and you can ask a question through 7# as well too. Remember that we take questions on a first name only basis, and that we do that because we believe that it encourages questions because there's some amenity to those questions. Let me start with a audio cast question that was typed in from Matthew. Is the tightening of credit spreads representative of an improvement as you do not have government purchases in those markets? Why are those spreads narrowing? Well, if you look at the chart, I guess, first of all, the chart we want to look at is on page 11. When we're talking about credit spreads, representative improvement is we do not have any government purchases. Yes, if you look at the narrowing, if you look at the chart in the upper left on page 11 of investment grade spreads, you'll see some narrowing there. If you look at the chart in the lower left in high yield, you'll see some narrowing there. We don't have government purchases in these markets. That's purely a market function of the buyers and sellers in the private market pulling back those spreads. So that is nominally an improvement in those markets. Does that mean that there's been healing in those markets? Yeah, there's been a nominal bit of healing in those markets. Same thing with the crossover index. And you could actually argue because leveraged loans are a price index, the same thing with price. The question is was that mid-December peak the peak in the market? That's the unknown question. I still think we're going to revisit that peak. I don't necessarily think we're going to go blasting through those peaks. If you look at high yield as one, yeah, we might nominally print a new wide above that 2178. Maybe we'll print 2200 just from above. But we're not going to, I don't think, go majorly through that unless we have another serious downturn. Again, these are the widest spreads that we've seen since the Great Depression. So yes, these markets are showing that there's been some buying in these markets, but that, I don't know, you could tell me as well, that after that parabolic rise in these markets, if we're actually, what we're seeing now is the beginning of the long turn towards massive tightening, or if we're just going to see consolidation up here. I think we're going to see consolidation up here. Let me take the next question from webcast from Brent. If banking and securitization make up 50% of the credit market, what is the remainder? That chart, let me find the page so that everybody can jump to page 4 on the handout. The big players here is the banking makes up 25% or so, and there's some overlap in this chart on page 4. Corporate bonds are a big player at around 33%. Mortgage debt is also big at around 40%. So most of mortgage debt, but not all of it, is securitized. A good part of corporate bonds is securitized as well, too. So what makes it up to 100 after banking, after securitization? You've got corporate bonds, and then you've got straight non-securitized mortgage debt. When you get to all of that, throw in commercial paper, or what the Federal Reserve Flow of Funds report calls open market paper, and then you wind up with 100% of the number. For those of you that are into this, this comes from the Federal Reserve's L4, the levels table L4 is where you can get this. You get this right, I'm sorry, the flow of funds report, table L4. It gives you all of these breakdowns. Tom asks, what approach do you feel that the U.S. government will take in regard to municipal market, outright purchases, CP-like funding mechanisms? At this point, it looks like what you're going to see in the muni market is you're going to see it being bailed out via the stimulus programs, that the government is going to pay for a lot of the programs that the municipalities cannot pay for, the quote-unquote shovel-ready projects. They're going to pay for those projects in lieu of the municipalities, so they're going to relieve them of the burdens of tightening their balancing their budgets and maybe issuing more debt. That's where I think they're going to go right now with it. And so we'll have to see where we go from there, whether or not the federal government is going to do more than that. But right now, the bailout for the munis is going to be the stimulus package paying for the shovel-ready projects. Robert writes, didn't the Dow fall by around 85% from the peak during the Great Depression, so stocks haven't had a similar sell-off? That's true. Stocks have not had a similar sell-off to the Great Depression, but, and this is a very important but, from peak to trough during the Great Depression, nominal GDP, nominal meaning real growth plus the inflation rate, fell by 46%. It fell by half. The size of the economy was cut in half during the Great Depression. The stock market fell 85%. Nominal GDP is still higher now than it was a year ago. When we get fourth quarter numbers, it's expected to be about zero. We're expecting that in 2009, at its worst, we could see nominal GDP fall for the first time since the 1950s. It hasn't fallen for the first time since the 1950s, but by no more than 10%. If you want to talk about why is the stock market not going to go down 85%, we didn't have the size of the economy this time around. We are going to see some contraction in the economy, some fall in nominal GDP, which is what people will define as depression, but we're not. Nobody thinks at this point we're going to see anything like what we saw in the Great Depression, in that the economy is going to fall by half. Unemployment hit 25% in the Great Depression. We're talking now as far as 9 or 10% being peak unemployment. So we're down 50%+ from the highs, but we don't have an economy that's nearly as bad now as we've seen in the prior ones. Some of the other questions, one comes from Bobby. What does the Fed buying long on treasuries achieve other than the precursive attempt to devalue the currency? I think really where the Fed, the talk about the Fed buying long-term treasuries, again, is more of the same of trying to reduce the overall level of interest rates. They're trying to bring interest rates lower through either purchases of mortgages, through purchases of agencies, or through purchases of treasuries, because everything's spread off of those, to try to bring them lower. Their belief is that if they bring rates lower, it will spur risk-taking. It will spur lending, and it will spur borrowing. If I drive treasury rates to zero, if I drive money market rates to zero, their idea is I will force you to take risk by buying something else to get a yield. Well, we'll see if that works. The historical references on that is very, very spotty. If they drive rates down, it will make you want to borrow. It maybe make the banks want to lend as opposed to getting zero on their treasuries and their other holdings as well, too. I understand the theory, but history has shown that, you know, when you have a flight to quality, it's because it's an emotional period where people are scared. It's not a risk-taking period. That in this environment, even though I'm getting zero on a money market fund or 2% on a 10-year treasury, the argument is it's not losing me 25% or 30% like a loan could or 50% like an equity could. And I'm not going to go buy those because I don't like zero. Sometimes people will be happy with zero because it's not minus 30. So that's one of the problems that the Fed is going to have to face. Brian writes, it appears that Obama will intervene in the foreclosure process in some fashion, bank cram downs or some other kind of modification for underwater homes. Do you think this is a net positive for the housing market, and what is the best way to front-run this trade? Cram downs are hurting the ABX, the CMBX. It's hurting the securitizations that are out there. We had a chart of it in our charts of the week, in news clips yesterday, that in the last couple of days since the announcement that Citibank agreed to the cram downs. And the cram downs, for those of you that are not familiar with it, is that there's going to be legislation proposed that is going to allow bankruptcy judges to modify the terms of your mortgage. Right now, they are not allowed in bankruptcy. If you go into personal bankruptcy, your mortgage can't be modified by a bankruptcy judge. Now they're talking about that it can be modified by a bankruptcy judge. The immediate reaction to that has been a sell-off in a lot of mortgage securitization products, because now we're going to have judges modifying. Currently, the only person that can modify it is the servicer, the mortgage servicer, who has been contracted by the owners, whoever owns the securitization, to act on their behalf in terms of the modification. But now that you're going to have judges doing it, the door is open. So that's where we've seen some of those. As far as the modifications go, the same thing, I think, as well. If there's a front run on this trade, I think it would be a sell-off an existing or seasoned mortgage paper, that the modifications are going to be deeper and harder than we're seeing with the servicers. And so you could see that paper sell off on the idea that we're going to try and engineer a social outcome with mortgages as opposed to an outcome designed to help the owners of that securities as well, too. The government's going to step in with attorneys and everybody else in terms of trying to get these modified. That would be my guess on that. Let me now jump to live questions. I know I've left you guys on for a little while. Michael, are you still with me?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Sorry for keeping you on so long.
No, not at all, Jim. Thank you for taking my question. Jim, it just occurred to me, the originators of the securitizations, which are now AWOL, have been the banks or the banking system. I mean, with the help of counting the brokers in, obviously, but for the most part, but the banks. Now, other than loss of headcount, why in principle can't the banks go out there and continue what they've done all along, namely originate these credits and accept in contrast to their previous practice, just take most of them back onto their balance sheet using the excess reserves that the Fed has basically given them?
I think the best way to answer that question is to take a look at the chart on page 3, and I would say that in some respects the banks have been originating. The chart on page 3 shows that if you look at the blue line, which is the year-over-year change in the size of domestic banking assets, the bank balance sheet has been growing at 13% over the previous year. That's one of the highest growth rates we've seen in the last 25 years. Banks are expanding their balance sheets. They are originating and holding on balance sheet and expanding their balance sheet. They're not distributing because the distribute model isn't there yet. They are doing it, but the fear is that that is going to start to slow down. And in fact, in 3-month changes in bank assets and some others, you started to see some kind of a slowdown in those numbers. Why are they going to slow down? Because they've originated a lot of paper now that is starting to go bad, and they are now starting to sit on another round of losses. They've also got the original losses that they have from 05, 06, 07 paper, which is eroding their bank capital as well, too. So if the argument is, why don't we just explode the bank balance sheets to make up for the, you know, and originate and hold, we've been trying to do that, but I think that in order to make up for the loss of securitization, to get back to the level of credit creation that the market was comfortable with, we would have to explode these balance sheets way more than we've seen right now. And the reason I point out that chart on the right on page 3 is the bank balance sheets are growing at the fastest levels in 25 or 28 years. Michael, did you have a follow-up to that?
No, thank you. That's great, Jim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next live question, if you're still with me, is Chris. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, Jim, thanks. Great discussion, and it dovetails with the previous question. If we look at the $1 trillion in losses, of course, a lot of that relates to securitization.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, we're looking for the answer to securitization or... So I think the issue is, the observation I would have is when we talk about the size of the economy and the size of the financial system and what securitization meant, securitization created a lot of the losses. So to me, it's right-sizing or downsizing, which we're going to go through with a negative GDP quarters, however many it is. So it's just an observation.
No, and your observation is right because, as you know, one of the things to keep in mind is the financial system is too small relative to the size of the real economy. The plug that's making the real economy stay at its current size is government programs and bailouts every day, including Merrill Lynch this morning, as we found out. If we want to get rid of the government bailouts, that means that we have to shrink the real economy. Shrinking the real economy sounds easy. Delevering the real economy, I mean, it sounds innocuous, but that means GM goes out of business, GMAC goes out of business, Merrill Lynch doesn't get its deal done, a lot of other unpleasant things happen. So we say we want delevering, but we really don't want delevering, you know, because it's very unpleasant. So you're right, we're kind of stuck in a point here where these government bailouts are going to be with us for a long time. And they are going to be committed to trying to prevent the real economy from shrinking and trying to be that part of the – basically, the federal government is going to become the lost securitization markets. If you want an idea of what the lost securitization markets mean for the financial system, look at the size of the bailouts and say, well, that's what it means. Because if we had securitization markets functioning – to the level that we had them functioning that would be on page 7, the table on page 7. If securitization markets were functioning like they did in 2007, 2006, there'd be no table on this page 7. Because the securitizations are not functioning, we have this mistaken belief that we want the banking system to go from a 25% credit creation market share to 60% immediately, and they can't do it. That's why we have the government there. The government's going to be with us for a long time. And like I've argued, maybe what we ought to start doing is thinking about what's going to get bailed out next and front-run that, because that seems to be about the only thing that's really been working lately, is trying to figure out where the Fed's next program that starts with T is going to come from and what they're going to start pushing down with that program. Chris, did you have a follow-up to that?
No, well, just not to that, but just the observation that we can decouple with respect to correlations, and on page 9, The investment grade market decouples a little bit. It decouples a little bit, and it is a pure market, as some, as your prior observer said. It is decoupled, and it is a pure market, but it only goes so far, which shows you that the unlevered, we're still a tension between where a levered versus unlevered clearing rate is for the cost of debt, which would go into the weighted average cost of capital for, you know, what, and that figures into what GDP should be, what, you know, what industrial America should be, the size of it.
I would agree with it, that there are definitely, you know, we have a two-tiered capital system. You know, there's the cost of capital you would get directly from the government, and then there's the cost of capital you would get from the private market. And that two-tiered system right now is producing two very, very different levels. The other problem with the two-tiered system is if you look at the Federal Reserve, what they're buying is established, seasoned types of credits. Let's take commercial paper. You have to apply to get a commercial paper funding facility approval to be able to sell your commercial paper to the Federal Reserve. Startups, new ventures, companies that have losses or big losses or are not deemed systemically significant, aren't going to get that. One of the things I think that's most interesting is I've asked this question rhetorically. I don't want to know who's getting TARP money. I don't want to know who's getting commercial paper funding. I want to know who was not approved by the Federal Reserve. Of course, that's the deepest secret that they hold, and the Treasury. Who didn't? Who applied for TARP and was turned down? Who applied to the Federal Reserve to sell them commercial paper and was turned down? The problem is that the risk-taking element is gone in this market. The people that can get funding are those big companies that they don't want to fail because they either have too many jobs or are considered too significant. And so without getting back to the capital markets, new capital formation is going to be very difficult to do in this environment because the cost of new capital formation is very high. Look at the high yield charts. Look at the investment grade charts. If you're not borrowing from the government, you're borrowing from the markets at 20%. Nobody's borrowing from the markets at 20%. And you're not going to be able to form new capital, and you're not going to be able to form new corporations or new jobs if we continue to have those kind of rates. So we definitely have to get this back in line and equilibrium as quickly as possible. And there's no easy way out. But again, I want to emphasize the last thought here, is I do think that the damage we've done to the markets is so great that while we might revisit the lows in stocks or the wides in credit in the first quarter, I don't think we're going to go significantly through it because we're already at the worst level since the 1930s, and the markets are telling us that this is a very bad place. All right, let me end the call there because I try to keep this call to an hour, and I'm already at 70 minutes. I've got some other emailed questions. I'll include them in the transcript. I'll answer them if I can directly after the call's over. If anybody else has got any questions, you can call me, you can email me. Thank you, and please join us on our next call in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.